This episode of Table Talk is sponsored by J-Food-O, dedicated to sharing the best Japan has to offer. Over the next few months, J-Food-O and a selection of London restaurants will create seafood and sake pairings for spectator listeners to help develop your knowledge and enjoyment of the drink. The pairing will focus on the concept of umami, which in Japanese means the essence of deliciousness.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Olivia Potts.
And I'm Lara Prendergast.
And today we're delighted to be joined by Lance Foreman. Lance is the owner of H. Foreman & Son, Britain's leading salmon smokers, and author of Foreman's Games. He was elected a Brexit Party MEP for London at the 2019 European election, but quit the party during the 2019 general election to endorse the Conservatives and formally joined them in January 2020. He was previously a special advisor to the Secretary of State for Trade and Industry. Lance, welcome to Table Talk.
Delighted to be here.
Lance, as listeners know, we always start with the same question, which is, what are your earliest memories of food?
My earliest memories of food, goodness, I'm sure I was probably fed like most babies are, with little sort of fruit purees stuffed down your throat and most of it sort of dripping around your chin. But I do remember, obviously being in the smoked salmon business, I do remember as a very young child, probably about 6 years old, maybe even slightly younger, my dad used to bring home a side of smoked salmon at the weekend. And it was always a treat, and he taught me to carve it then when I was six, holding a very sharp knife. I'm sure he would have been taken away nowadays. But back in those days, you know, it was something that you did, because there was no such... I mean, you couldn't buy smoked salmon in a supermarket 50 years ago. You'd only buy it somewhere where they'd sort of carve it at the counter for you. So it was all freshly carved, and that was something we did. Of course, in those days, it was all wild smoked salmon as well. There was no such thing as salmon farming, because that didn't kick off till the late 70s, early 80s.
And what were mealtimes like in your family?
Well, mealtimes are always a big deal. We come from quite a traditional Jewish family. We were quite a large family. I had three sisters, and we all sat down together, usually a three-course meal on a Friday night, maybe even a four-course meal, but it was always quite formal, and it was always, you know, you had to be, the family always sort of sat down together for a meal. So it was, you know, it was a really good time.
Mm. And what sort of things would you be eating, particularly the formal meals that you're having together? What would be served?
Well, unsurprisingly... smoked salmon often feature. And you might think that being in the smoked salmon business, I'd be absolutely sick of it by now, and we might have been sick of it, but it did feature quite often, actually. Again, there would usually be a soup course, quite often a chicken soup, and then usually a sort of meat course, and then, a pudding, or it might be a bit of fruit or something, some grapefruit or whatever. But it was quite a formal occasion, sitting down for dinner. But say the smoked salmon just literally featured everywhere. I used to be given smoked salmon sandwiches for school every single day.
Fancy. And
it was sort of amazing. But you do, you know, I sort of, you know, as a child, I got a little bit bored, and I was I had the best friends at school, because everybody wanted to swap their sandwiches for mine, and it was quite refreshing to have some alternatives occasionally.
We normally actually ask a question about school food, but it sounds like you had quite happy memories of school food.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, but I was always a bring your own sandwiches in child, basically, because I couldn't eat the school meals because they weren't kosher, and so I had to sort of stick with kosher food. So it was always a packed lunch.
Apart from the slicing of the smoked salmon, did you learn to cook as a child? Were you interested in cooking as opposed to produce?
I've always loved cooking, actually. My mum was a great cook, and I don't know whether I got it from her, but I've just always loved cooking. I used to love, you know, again, in those early days, watching all those TV chef programs, the Roux Brothers, that they were fantastic. You know, even back to the Galloping Gourmet and Fanny Craddock, probably, I think, is certainly before post, probably most of your listeners' time. But I used to love doing those, and I started I think I was about 18, I started this sort of annual tradition where I used to cook this New Year's Eve dinner. And it was a sort of 10, 12, even 14, 15 course meal that would sort of start at 10 in the evening, go on till about 4 o'clock in the morning. And it always became a bit of a competition for friends to see who would get the invitation. But that tradition lasted for a good old 10 years, I would say. Yeah.
And after school, you went to Trinity College, Cambridge, where you were president of the union. This is actually something Liv probably has more experience of asking, but what was that like? What was the food like during your time at Cambridge and at the union in particular?
College food, again, wasn't brilliant. It wasn't great, but I used to dine out. There were some pretty good restaurants back in those days. There was one particular one, I don't know if it's still around actually, called Angeline. It had been there for many years near the Arts Theatre, lovely little restaurant. But I was also very fortunate because I had in my own room, would you believe, a little kitchenette, and I had my own kitchen, and I would actually, you know, cook very nice meals for myself. Often made dinner parties at college actually. And
what sort of thing were you cooking?
Oh, God, anything. I mean, you know, it's pretty basic in those days, obviously, because, you know, as a 20-year-old, you don't start, you know, it's not going to be that gastronomic. But, you know, could have been anything from, you know, pasta dishes to, you know, any. I mean, obviously it had to be fairly basic because you didn't have a huge kitchen and lots of pots and pans around you. But, you know, it was a place that people would come and enjoy, and, you know, not that many students had the opportunity to do that or that were that interested, actually. So it was my college room was always a bit of a hub for lots of good food, great drinking sessions, well, lots of wine to go with. So that was always
and
a bonus.
At the union, were there lots of good parties?
Well, at the union, we used to have these dinners before the debates. So you'd have these sort of formal black tie dinners, and they were always great. Mm. And in fact, I remember my own presidential dinner. It was hosted in the Trinity kitchens. They have these absolutely stunning old kitchens. And we did make quite a big deal out of that final sort of dinner, for my presidential. That's where it was my last dinner as president of the union. Trinity kitchens, famous for the invention of creme brulee.
Really?
Yeah, Trinity cream. It's known as Trinity cream. Yeah, I think the chef, it was a few hundred years ago, I think the chef accidentally burnt the cream and they tasted it and thought, oh, this is actually rather good. And and creme brulee was born at Trinity Kitchen. So there we go.
And after Cambridge, you qualified as a chartered accountant. Was there ever any suggestion that you would go straight into the family business? Were you rebelling by going into chartered accountancy? Did you feel the pull of the smoked salmon at that point?
Well, That's a very good question. I actually wanted to be, I've always been quite crazy. I wanted to be an architect, and there was a big fight in my, you know, A-level time at school, whether I should go down the sort of art route or the sort of economics route. And I think the economics side of the teaching profession managed to persuade both me and my parents that that was the route I should go down. But there was always a view that I would perhaps join the family business, and we thought that doing accountancy would probably be quite a good training for running a business at some later stage. It wasn't my lifetime ambition to be a chartered accountant. It was actually quite a miserable time, I have to say. And immediately after I qualified, I started looking around for jobs in the food industry, and was offered a job actually for a large sort of food PLC. And it was only when I handed in my notice, this was at Price Waterhouse, way back when, that they persuaded me to hang about and stay on. They just started up this brand new department dealing with privatisation. And politically, that was quite interesting to me. You know, Thatcher was in power at the time, and it was, and I was quite a political animal. And I thought, you know what, this could be quite interesting. And I stuck with it and stayed on for another 3 years.
And you then were in Kiev for a little bit. Tell us about that, and what was the food like in Kiev?
Well, it was actually the privatization that led to me going off to Eastern Europe and to Kiev. Within a year of joining that department, Eastern Europe or Central and Eastern Europe started to open up, and I spent almost the best part of a year traveling backwards and forwards to Poland and helping Polish companies on privatization being valued and so on. And I could see that there were spectacular opportunities, and I've always believed that, you know, business opportunities exist all around us, but they're huge. You know, these once in a lifetime business opportunities usually happen after massive political upheaval, and I thought that my generation's political upheaval would be the collapse of communism in the Eastern Bloc. And I decided that, you know, I really wanted to do a lot more than these big international firms are doing. And I bumped into an architect. So there we were, back into architecture again. Bumped into this British architect. And we had this idea of trying to sort of make a go of it in Eastern Europe. And within a couple of years, we plunged into Kiev. It was on the back of a project that we were doing for a Canadian investor, and we both fell in love with the city, and we thought that, you know, maybe this would be the place where we'd make our future. The food side of things was quite interesting because I'd be taken out to sort of, I mean, it's very basic in those days, but restaurants just in the middle of nowhere. And I'd be looking down these sort of menus at the food that was available. And all of the food reminded me of traditional Jewish food. And what I very clearly realized was that Jewish food isn't necessarily Jewish. It was East European. And, you know, things like dumplings known as knedlach, they would have them on the menu in these Russian, you know, or Ukrainian restaurants, knedlachy and kreplachy, which are like little ravioli, which are Jewish food, but it's not actually, it's Ukrainian food. So that was, you know, it was quite interesting to see that.
And in the 90s, you took over H. Foreman and Sons from your father. Tell us how that came about and how it felt to take on the family business.
Well, you know, having spent quite a bit of time over in Eastern Europe, a decision really had to be made with, you know, whether or not I was going to live there full time. I was married at that stage, had one child at that stage, or not. And my wife and I had a very brief discussion. As far as she was concerned, it lasted about 2 seconds. And we decided, no, Kiev is not going to be where we were going to move to. Although my architect partner did stay there, and he was literally there up until a couple of weeks ago. So he's been there. He remarried. He was divorced at that stage and had 3 children. But fortunately, they're all in the UK at the moment. So they did get out before the war started. But I decided, no, that maybe this is the moment that I do, like a salmon, return to its native river and join the family business. And I've been here 27 years ever since then.
And can you tell us a bit about the history of the business? Because it was founded by your great-grandfather, and he was an immigrant from Odessa.
He was indeed. So again, all very much in the news at the moment. So my great-grandfather, Aaron Foreman, came from Odessa. He was known as Harry Foreman, hence the H, Foreman and Son. And he was a Jewish immigrant that was fleeing the pogroms of Eastern Europe, Ukraine, in the late 19th century, settled in the East End of London. There was quite a large wave of Jewish immigration into London at that time. And he settled in the East End and, you know, looking around for something to do. And fish smoking was something that the, you know, East Europeans were quite familiar with. And I think it was, from what I understand, he had a little cafe in the East End of London. And it was his son, actually, that was that saw other people smoking salmon and said, look, Dad, we can do this. And they set up the smokery. And so we weren't the first salmon smokers around in London's East End, but we are now the last remaining salmon smokers in the East End. And I've been claiming for the last 15 years, we're actually now the oldest producer of smoked salmon in the world. And nobody has said to me, no, you're not, Mr. Foreman. So it must be true.
And Lance, tell us about the salmon itself. You have the London cure salmon that you're well known for, and your salmon comes from Scotland. Tell us about the kind of process for the salmon.
Okay, so a lot of people think that smoked salmon is an ancient Scottish tradition, because of course the Scots had this great reputation. Well, Scottish salmon had a great reputation, and the Scots are quite famous for smoked fish. Kippers, Arbroath Smokies, Finn and Haddock, and so on. But they tend to be very smoky. And if you're a chef putting on a, you know, an important banquet, you'd never start the meal with a kipper, because you're going to taste it after the chocolate pudding 5 courses later. And what happened in East London, what my granddad or great granddad was doing, was that they didn't, in fact, when they first arrived here, they didn't even realize there was a salmon native to the UK. So they were shipping over salmon from the Baltic and smoking that for their own community, not as a gourmet food. It was just a way of preserving fish. And they went to the fish market at Billingsgate, and they saw these amazing wild salmon coming down from Scotland every summer. And they thought, well, why don't we just use the local fish? It'll be a lot easier. So they started smoking the Scottish salmon, and the product was incredible. And so they started hawking it around to famous places like the Savoy Hotel and Selfridges and Harrods. And people fell in love with this new product. And smoked salmon was born as a gourmet food in East London. It was the marriage of the London curing method with Scottish salmon. And what was different about that method was that it was a way of, you know, you wanted people to taste the fish. It was all about, you know, preserving the taste of the king of fish, wild salmon. So you'd salt the fish to draw the moisture out. And when it was sufficiently dry, that's when you release the smoke, because as the fish cures, instead of being a wet, slippery sort of piece of fish, it becomes a sort of sticky textured fillet. And then the smoke sticks to the outside, and that essentially creates a seal, and that is what protects it. So the smoke in smoked salmon is a preserving method. It's not a flavouring. When you eat smoked salmon, when you eat fine smoked salmon, it shouldn't really taste of smoke. It's, you know, it's all about the salmon. If they would have invented vacuum packing 100 years ago, maybe no one would have come up with the idea of smoking the fish in the first place. But it's, you know, the London cure, say, is a traditional method we've been doing, you know, for our, well, all those years, 116 years.
And as you said at the start, salmon has obviously become much more kind of prominent. You see it in the supermarkets everywhere. What do you make of that explosion of salmon onto the market?
Well, in a way, it's a good thing, but in a way, it's also a bad thing. And that's why we love doing podcasts and things like this, to actually re-educate the public about smoked salmon. Because, you know, 30 years ago, you could just mention those two words, smoked salmon, and people go, ooh, smoked salmon. It was a really big deal. It was something special. And nowadays, you know, the ooh is often ooh. It's a slightly different tone. And, you know, we've done a lot of consumer events, and you say to somebody, you know, would you like to try some smoked salmon? And they go, no, no, it's fine, thanks. Which they wouldn't have said 30 years ago. They would have said, what, are you completely bonkers? I'll have as much as you can give me. But people have been put off, and a lot of smoked salmon now is just very slimy. It's very smoky. And, you know, even 2 or 3 hours later, you need 10 peppermint chewing gums to get rid of the taste. And the mass production of smoked salmon, which has resulted from salmon farming, has changed the nature and the way it's been produced. And, you know, a lot of even younger chefs don't really understand what smoked salmon was all about. And it should be very natural. We were very proud, actually, back in 2017, after a 4-year application, to get a special status for London Cure smoked salmon. So it has something called PGI status, or geographic indication status, the same status that Champagne has, Parma ham, Cornish pasties. London Cure smoked salmon became the first ever London-based food or drink to have that special status. Of course, I was accused of mass hypocrisy, because there I was getting an EU award and becoming a Brexiter and Brexit Party MEP, and then eventually, as you said, Tory MEP. But life's confusing sometimes.
It sure is.
And aside from smoked salmon, what do you like to cook and eat in your downtime?
I'm sort of one of these sort of people that won't generally plan my food. I'll just go to the fridge and see what's there and pretty much knock up whatever I can at the time. Obviously, if you're doing a dinner party, it's a very different thing. But I'm also very, very lucky in that I run a food business, which has now diversified very dramatically over the last 20 years. We set up an online home delivery service called Foreman and Field 20 years ago, specializing in the best of British food. And we make about, you know, I've got an amazing team of chefs, and we make, you know, over 500 different food products. And so it's almost like having a team of sous chefs. So if I actually ever do need to entertain at home, it's a bit of a cheat, actually. But, you know, I do have most of the prep done for me. But that's what all our Foreman and Field customers do, actually, because it's all handmade. So they sort of buy it in and pretend they've made it themselves. And, you know, we have everything. I mean, we've got some just amazing products, you know, from, you know, beef Wellingtons to, you know, we do a cheese, the same cheese souffle you get in the Gavroche, the souffle Suissesse, and so on, some amazing puddings. We've just launched a new pudding for the Jubilee called the Elizabeth Sponge.
Which we should say you've actually brought in to try, and is very delicious.
Again.
Well, I challenged our chefs to come up with something interesting for the Platinum Jubilee. It's a very exciting, historic moment. And they've sort of done a twist on a Victoria sponge. So it's a sponge cake with seven layers of sponge, one for each decade of the Queen on the throne. And then we did a bit of research into the Queen's favourite puddings and tipples and so on. And we found out that she loves lemon posset. And she's also a big fan of Dubonnet, and who isn't? So we have the seven layers of sponge, and they're interleaved with lemon posset cream, sort of mixed with buttercream, so very tangy. And then we've made a Dubonnet jam and Dubonnet glaze on the top, and the flavours actually work superbly, and it's really delicious. We're launching it later this month, just in time for Mother's Day, because, of course, Her Majesty is the mother of the nation, so there we go.
It's very delicious. And Lance, for a while, Foreman and Field have advertised in the back pages of The Spectator. Are Spectator readers big smoked salmon fans?
Well, of course they are, because they're very intelligent readers and they have exquisite taste. And yes, they are. We've been making quite a lot of the food for your spectator lunches over a number of years now. And in fact, late this year, May the 6th, we are doing the first ever spectator tour of our smokehouse with this fabulous lunch afterwards and some smoked salmon tastings. And I think there are still a few places left if any of the listeners are interested in coming along. So May the 6th, do come. I'll see you there.
And for any listeners who are interested in the smokehouse tour, just go to the Spectator website where you'll find more details on the Spectator shop page. Lance, we normally finish with a question about your desert island meal. What would your desert island meal be?
Goodness, a desert island meal. God, where do I start? I mean, fish would have to feature in there somewhere, because when you're on the desert, I mean, there's nothing better than fresh fish. I mean, you cannot get a better food than fresh fish. You probably wouldn't get salmon on a desert because they like cold water. So they have to be a slightly warmer water fish. I love sea bass, actually, so sea bass will be fantastic. I'm a huge fan of artichokes. Whenever I go to a restaurant and there's artichokes on the menu, that's almost a dead cert. And then I also love, so puddings. I like sort of, you know, Indian sort of spice type puddings. They're things with saffron and cardamom and so maybe something sort of spongy and gooey and lots of lovely sort of spices in there too would be a perfect way to finish. But
would you have a drink?
Would have a drink. I'd probably start and finish with Negronis. I mean, why wouldn't you? But I do love a Negroni. I have to say it is my weakness. But yeah, whiskey. Love whiskey. Love fizz. Who doesn't? Fizz and smoked salmon. Some partnerships have become quite cliched, but they really do. You know, I've tried smoked salmon. I've done so many different tests with other sorts of wines, but just fizz. And also some of the English wines, which we've again been promoting for about 20 years now. Some of them are really fantastic. Some really amazing English sparklings.
Lance, thank you very much for joining Table Talk.
Thank you for joining us on the Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories, and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website.